Large-scale Russian attacks on Ukrainian cities have triggered Germany to search for Patriot air defense systems for Ukraine. NATO states will discuss the idea of creating a support fund for Kyiv. You're listening to the Explain Ukraine podcast. Explain Ukraine is a podcast by Ukraine World, an English language website about Ukraine. My name is Volodymyr Yarmolenko. I'm a Ukrainian philosopher, journalist, and chief editor of Ukraine World. I'm joined by my colleagues Anastasia Harasymchuk and Daria Sinhaevska, journalists and analysts at Ukraine World, to discuss key events in and around Ukraine for the last week. Ukraine World is brought to you by Internews Ukraine, one of the largest Ukrainian media NGOs. Let me remind you that you can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld. You can also support our volunteer trips to the front lines at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. You can find these links in the description of this episode.
The Washington Post has published the article called "Inside Donald Trump's Secret Longshot Plan to End the War in Ukraine." In this publication, the journalists refer to their own secret sources. And this article tells about the Trump's plan, how he sees the ending of the war between Russia and Ukraine. And it tells that Trump's plan is about putting pressure on Ukraine to make it give up some territories, namely those ones which are occupied by Russia. These are Crimea, Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast, and parts of Zaporizhia and Kherson Oblast, which are currently under occupation. Trump and his team deny these statements from the article, and they emphasize that actually the journalists, the authors of the article, refer to unknown sources, and they wouldn't know what talks and discussions are going on within the Trump's team. I'm mentioning it not to analyze political rumors or discredit the participants of political process in the United States. It's not our task to analyze the internal processes in allies' countries. But these talks, publications, rumors, whatever, show turbulent political processes in the United States of America, especially, and in other countries which are our allies and partners. So the United States of America are in their election process. The state is preparing for their presidential elections. At the same time, we see that on the third year of the full-scale invasion, the views and opinions among politicians and opinion makers within the allies state got various, and there are more voices that oppose the idea to enhance support to Ukraine. And it's all happening amid the delays with allocating funds for Ukrainian aid package by the United States of America. All these processes in the United States are combined with the elections processes in Europe as well. And the results of presidential elections in Slovakia are quite telling. Peter Pellegrini is a new Slovakian president. He's ally of the country's prime minister, Robert Fico, and he's notorious for his ambiguous position towards Russian aggression against Ukraine. The results of presidential elections were quite unexpected for the observers and experts. However, we are going to observe and watch how the Slovakian policy, especially foreign policy, is going to unfold. So, domestic political processes in the Ukraine's Western allies can be challenging for Ukraine and are actually challenging for Ukraine, but not only for our state. The delays and hesitance towards the enhancing Ukraine's capabilities and support to Ukraine are dangerous for Europe as well and for the order, for liberal world order we know. And when we talk about the threats for Europe, of course, we mentioned the military threats, but not only. And let's just recall the Gerasimov's doctrine. Gerasimov is currently a commander-in-chief of the Russian army, and he is the author of the military strategy of Russian Federation, which is still actual. And he mentions that the world entered the stage of new types of war, which necessitates combination of military and non-military means. And here he emphasizes the importance of using non-conventional means. And actually, that's what Russia is doing. They are fighting war not only by military means. They are interfering and interfering within the political processes in the West, and they are undermining democracy. So Gerasimov mentions the global Russian aims, and these aims cannot be achieved only by military means. And while talking about these non-conventional methods, he mentioned not only propaganda tools and active use of social media. The tools Russia is actively using is also influencing the political processes, like inspiring protest movements or like putting emphasis on political opposition, which is populist, which is Eurosceptical or Western skeptical. Russia is actively detecting vulnerabilities of their Western enemies, let's say so. And they are looking for these economic and political vulnerabilities. And in parallel, Russia is pouring money into controlled media within these communities, controlled social media channels, politicians and different think tanks and non-governmental organizations. That's what is necessary to keep in mind for our Western allies when it comes to Russian threats. And Europe is getting closer to understanding these threats, especially if we look at the recent statements and the stance the French president took. On the 4th of April, the NATO-Ukraine Council meeting took place, and the allies were actively discussing how to effectively enhance the Ukrainian capabilities and what to do not to let Ukraine lose. And among different things, several ideas were proposed and were discussed during this meeting, including the NATO's leading role in Rammstein format or creating fund, NATO fund that would finance Ukrainian capabilities. So what steps are being taken by Ukrainian partners and can be taken now to secure Ukrainian security and capabilities in the unpredictable future?
Yes, and while thinking about this international landscape, the role of NATO and the EU, I guess we have to look closer to its constituting parts to understand the whole tendency of this organization. And as you said, this new stance of French President Emmanuel Macron somehow disturbs our minds with why has Macron been so surprisingly new in his statements towards support of Ukraine. And the answer I came to is threefold. I mean, we have to see this desire for leadership on the global level, on the EU level, and the level of basically France. So when we think about the global scope, we see that France has recently been trying to pursue a policy independent of the United States. The first example that came to my mind is the one about the scandal between France and Australia over the termination of the submarine deal back in 2021. So we see this strife for pursuing independent and a strong policy on the global arena. At the EU level, we see Macron has had the opportunity to seize this leadership from Scholz, because we know that the main founding fathers of the EU project was France and Germany, and this is the time when Macron tries to gain this strategic position. And at the level of France, we see that not only a strong leadership can protect his like political legacy from right-wing populists, but also his stance on ancestries, let's say so, because this traditionality in French policy and the idea of taking powers by far rights are extremely sensitive. And as far as we know, Macron is not going to ballot himself for the next elections as a candidate for president. But he tries to support his party and the political weight of his party. And over time, France began to realize that this calls to Putin had no effect other than this negative image of France that not gaining some scores for this threefold aims in leadership. And therefore, France's position began to change rather quickly. We see that France became one of the advocates of Ukraine's EU membership in early 2022. And in 2023, it switched to supporting NATO membership for Ukraine. And France was one of the first countries to provide Kyiv with large-scale artillery. We should not underestimate that Paris made great efforts to lift the so-called tank blockade, the West's reluctance to supply the Ukrainian armed forces with the latest tanks. And we also remember that the agreement to supply the light tanks paved the way to lift this blockade from supply of Leopard tanks. Further, it was France, together with Britain, who that broke the veto on the supply of long-range Scalp Storm Shadow missiles. And plus, there is a feature of France that distinguishes it from all other continental European countries. For many years, the European military has been involved in not only in spending military budgets, but also in assisting the United States, for example, in Afghanistan or Iraq. And instead, the French army is only one in the European Union that had been actively engaged in combat in a number of hotspots in Africa, for example. And we also remember that it has often been confronted by Russian armed units. In recent years, this military waves of having this global voice of France has suffered some defeats in states in Central and Western Africa, and Russia was often the directly tied with those opponents. One of the most recent of such defeats was the loss of French influence in Niger, where a military coup supported by Wagner groups took place, and that affected the supply of some raw materials that that is the base of French nuclear power plants. So therefore, for France, taming Putin is more important than just a desire for leadership and justice. The threats made by Russian government officials, for example, Dmitry Medvedev or Solovyov, who discussed the possibility of missile attacks on French cities, have resonated in France, but resonated in specific way. Instead of frightening French society, these threats seem to be reinforcing the understanding that Russian government and Russia, with its citizens who support the regime, is impossible to negotiate with, and that its policies are a threat to all European countries. And amid this background of slow disenchantment, let's call it in such way, we see that NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg has proposed creating a fund to help Ukraine, and this fund should reach about $100 billion over 5 years. The important thing is that as part of this package, NATO may also take over the operational responsibilities of the US-led Rammstein format, which coordinates the supply of weapons to Ukraine from around 50 countries. And it's important to understand that these measures are primary measures to be sure that in times of changes, including political ones, this is an attempt to secure support for Ukraine when political leadership in the United States might change. And, basically this Supreme Allied Commander General Christopher Cavoli, who leads the NATO, can protect the structure from any political changes that may arise after the US presidential elections. And we know that recently New York Times wrote that the United States and Germany do not want to invite Ukraine to join NATO to avoid dragging the alliance into war. And we remember the story in 2008 when NATO countries didn't agree to give Ukraine a membership action plan because they were also afraid of war in Europe. And we remember the strong opposition of Germany. 6 years later, in 2014, a war broke out, which in 2022 turned into the largest military confrontation in Europe since World War II. We are here now in 2024, and in case of NATO doesn't agree to give Ukraine this green light to join, we see again the threat of Russia's forces going into European countries, suppressing a power will of nation states. And time is playing into Russia's hands, not NATO's. This was the case in 2008, and it will continue to be the case simply because Russia has a plan to invade, and while NATO acts in less than, let's call it, reactive way.
Indeed, when we talk about the actions that are being taken by Ukraine's allies, we see that, yes, we are observing some changes in rhetoric by certain states, as France, for example, but still our Western allies are trying to calibrate every their step, and they are quite hesitant because of some concerns regarding the escalation, etc. But here, in this case, it's very important to understand the nature of Russia as a state. And as we mentioned more than once, as we always emphasized, Russia is that power which understands only power. And being hesitant in face of its threat is only a motivational force for Russia to continue its aggressive actions. And while talking about alliances and support and supplies, let's just pay attention to the Russian allies. And that's actually very important to pay attention to this fact, because such alliances have these global danger, and this cooperation might bear much more negative consequences for the global order in general. So recently, there were news about the enhanced cooperation between China and Russia, and every time we receive new portions of information about weapons supplies or some detail supplies or some components for precise weapon supplies. And recently there were news about China providing Russia with satellite images so that it can plan operations against Ukraine and Ukrainian cities, more precisely knowing where the objects of their interests are located. So when we look at Russia's allies, we see that they do not hesitate to take decisive actions. And actually, Russia is able to avoid the negative, the biggest part of negative consequences from sanctions, just thanks to their allies' support. And even though China denies that it is Russian ally, and it claims its neutral status, still the facts about microchips, integral circuits, supply satellite images proves opposite. And according to some analysts, China helps Russia to rearm. And thanks to these supplies, actually Russia can build its missiles and can continue operating their defense and military industry. And what is also alarming, and even the United States of America pay attention to this threat, that China and Russia are enhancing their cooperation in the space area. So that's something to take into account and take into account very seriously to make decisions about.
For sure, and it's of great importance to borrow this, you know, Max Weber's stance on disenchantment that I mentioned, that is the retreat of magic from social life through processes of secularization and rationalization. And that's the point and approach we should take when thinking about this war and Russia's role in building its imperial worldview. So since 2022, the world stepped into the face of this disenchantment, freeing from this special Russia's role in colonizing nation states. And this is the case with culture as well. A Russian writer, Mikhail Bulgakov, was recognized as a symbol of Russian imperial policy, and the presence of monuments in his honor in the public space is considered propaganda for this Russian imperial policy. And Bulgakov despised Ukrainians and Ukrainian culture, hated desire for independence, and spoke negatively about the formation of the Ukrainian state and its leaders. So the conclusion of the Ukrainian Institute of National Memory also states that among all the writers of the time, he stands closest to the current ideologies and those who spoke for this ideologies of Putinism and the Kremlin's justification of ethnocide in Ukraine. And therefore, the naming of geographical objects, naming of legal entities, or erection of monuments in his honor in Ukraine was the embodiment of Russification as part of this Russian imperial policy. And encoding imperialism in literature is very visible in Russian case. I had pleasure to speak with Miroslav Shkandy, who is a bright historian, and he put it explicitly that the imperial discourse pervaded every aspect of Russian political and intellectual life. So it first manifested itself clearly in the work of historian Nikolai Karamzin, who believed that Russia's size necessitates absolutist rule as well as the forced integration and colonization of subject peoples. In 1969, Nikolai Ryazanovsky wrote that Russia expanded to become Slavdom, Russian destiny advanced to the Elbe, Vienna, and Constantinople. And we see this preemption, you know, this tradition of justifying its imperial policy in literature in particular. And those world-known authors like Alexander Pushkin and Fyodor Tuchev wrote poems celebrating the defeat of the Polish Revolution and the slaughter of Poles in Warsaw suburbs. So it's not only about Ukrainians in focus, it's about neighboring states, and not only neighboring, whom, to the view of the Russian imperial writers, should be subjected to the will of the empire. And we know that Tuchev claimed in his well-known poem Russian Geography in 1949 that Russia had no borders, and we remember that phrase coming from the mouth of Russian dictator Putin, who also stated that Russia had no borders, and that's the result we have now. So this tradition of justifying military might, the power of military means throughout the literature and in Russia's history, and living in such circumstances, Ukraine has developed its own voice, trying to pave the third wave, not only to create an anti-colonial thesaurus, but also to be in post-colonial avant-garde, you know, because the term anti-colonial has represented a focus on opposition, like periphery to center or colony to empire, while the term post-colonial has represented a desire to move beyond these binaries. And Ukraine has plenty of such post-colonial writers and writings that often deconstructs these attitudes and forms of expression by placing them, you know, like in broader comparative context. And that's the point of post-colonial studies and post-colonial attitude, to fathom the imperial legacy and to not only resisting it, but showing why it's not the case and why this or that state has a right for waging independent policy and not just being some periphery to an empire.
What you've just told, Dasha, made me remember about another instance of Russian colonization and colonial policies, actually. When we talk about culture in broader sense, we shouldn't forget about the education and knowledge. So turns out it's possible to colonize knowledge, and that's what Russia actually has done. And Ukraine is coping, is trying to cope with the consequences of the colonization of knowledge. I spoke with Nadia Koval, who is the head of Research Analytics and Academic Programs Department at the Ukrainian Institute, and we had a very interesting and insightful conversation about the colonization of knowledge about Ukraine by Russia and how Ukraine can cope with this. So when we talk about the knowledge about Ukraine and former USSR republics or territories which were subordinated to the Russian Empire, we understand that the knowledge about these currently independent states were formed in Russia, actually. So Russia was this colonial center. That is why it dictated the knowledge, the scope of knowledge, the narrative within which this knowledge was formed. And that's a dangerous thing, and actually that's an entangling thing. And when the full-scale invasion started, the Western, first of all, Western political scientists and experts in the international relations sphere faced a huge challenge, because their knowledge about Ukraine was, as I've mentioned, formed by Russia, by, let's say, not exactly by Russia, but by the discourse that was created in the Russian institutions. So even when the war in 2014 started, there were numbers of intellectual discourses and historians, scientists, like experts, political experts, were talking about the ideas that were imposed by Russia about the single nation, about the historical destiny of Russia and Ukraine to be together. And they believed in these divisions within Ukrainian society, within which the part of Ukrainian population allegedly supported Russia, etc. Focusing on these narratives, the Western academia thought lost very important angles and insights about the reality and real history and real truth about Ukraine and Russian imperial nature. So the full-scale invasion happened while those leaders of thoughts and academians were, they actually believed in the possibility to talk to Russia. They believed in this, let's say, so-called reasonable territorial and influence compromises. But what happened actually is a full-scale aggression, because Russia didn't face the decisive response. And it was certain kinds of entangled, let's say, the Western experts and scientists, because according to the narrative and paradigm within which they were analyzing Ukraine, Russia, and post-Soviet space, this invasion shouldn't have happened. But the reality is the way we see it now. And to solve this problem, it is actually very important to understand why the intellectual community used to think about Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, and any other countries from former Russian sphere of influence in a certain way. It is necessary to analyze the origins of these misconceptions and why those narratives, why those instruments fail to explain the reality. And it is even more important than just debunk myths created by Russian propaganda and fact check what is disseminated by Russian intellectual circles. So when we talk about why this Russian imperial knowledge was imposed and disseminated around the world, it is there is explanation in two layers, in two dimensions. The first one, of course, is Russian activity, and Russia was actually actively instrumentalizing its culture, education, foreign policy, and it created a vast network of soft power organizations around the world. And it actively used these tools to justify the current aggression, its objectives, and it keeps using this institution to denigrate the Ukrainian resistance. But that's only the part of the story. Another dimension is about the, let's say, historical tradition, and it's less obvious factor, but it's worth mentioning and it's worth paying attention to. So when scientists, academians, analysts want to obtain knowledge about the Eastern Europe, about, let's say, post-Soviet space, including Ukraine, they turn to Russian institutions and Russian knowledge produced by Russia, because it was a former imperial center. And as a result, it was the center of knowledge production, education, and valued expertise. That is why the researchers turn to Russian archives, sources, specialists, and the narratives that they used, maybe unconsciously, because it's like this inner tendency to turn to the imperial center. So these narratives were formed and supported by Russia, and it is clear why these narratives sounded and looked the way they did. In this situation for Ukraine, it is very important to, like, using this moment when the truth got to surface and when the Western academic thoughts realized that previous discourses, previous narratives were false. It is very important for Ukraine to enhance the Ukrainian studies around the globe. And that's actually what Ukraine is actively doing. It is engaged in various initiatives, dialogues, information campaigns aimed at making Ukraine better known to the world. However, it is also very important to take more systemic steps and to develop academic and intellectual production, Ukrainian production in the global context. So it is important not only to develop the Ukrainian studies programs and launch information campaigns, it is also critically important to make Ukrainian academic thought known in the world. So the voice of Ukrainian academia and analytical circles should be heard around the globe. So there are no quick solutions in this regard, and decolonize knowledge is a very challenging task, especially taking into account this long-formed tradition of using these Russian-created narratives. So these solutions should be systemic, and the long-term engagement in supporting and promoting knowledge about Ukraine throughout the world is needed.
Yes, this bright combination of launching Ukrainian studies abroad, developing its programs, together with giving the floor to prominent and most important expertise voices of Ukrainian community, as the list is very long. I mean, Marko Pavlyushin, Vitaliy Chernetsky, Mykola Rybchuk, Yuri Andruhovich, and so on and so forth, all this community plus Ukrainian studies make this a combination extremely bright and important. And while listening to you, Nastya, I only made my mind strong that Russia wages total war. I mean, total war is such a modification that targets all the nation. It's not only about targeting facilities, infrastructure, logistics, military. It's about waging the war of destruction and of mainly of destruction of the nation. This was the second war, world war, and now one against Ukraine that Russia wages against civilians who do not have any like military significance, but they have significance of constructing and building Ukrainian nation. They are those voices, and they are Ukraine. So this total war, includingly targeting Ukrainian nation and Ukrainian civilians at night, a day, during lunch, during work, during sleep, it's another feature of Russia, right?
That's true, and you, Dasha, put us closer to a painful topic, which we mention very often in our episodes. We often talk about the Russian attacks on Ukrainian territory, on Ukrainian peaceful cities, and this episode will not be an exception, because what we call a Russian terror from air is going on, and Russia is getting more and more active in its terror activities. Like these last 2 weeks, Ukraine has faced unprecedented levels of attacks. Like we are hearing these air raid alerts many times during the day, and different parts of Ukraine are being shelled several times a day. So if it's not the whole territory of Ukraine, like during the massive attacks at nights that actually took place over these two last weeks, then these attacks are targeted against certain city or certain region, and it happens indeed several times a day in different parts of Ukraine. And here I can't help mentioning Kharkiv, which suffered the heaviest Russian attacks over the last 2 weeks. And it's not possible not to recall the Russian propagandists' words about Kharkiv. Actually, Vladimir Solovyov, so-called Russian journalist, told that Russia needs to completely destroy Kharkiv. And that's actually what Russia is doing. So Kharkiv is suffering various types of attacks during day and night. And these are artillery shells, if we talk about Kharkiv Oblast, and these are ballistic missiles attacks and drones attacks, if we talk about Kharkiv itself. And what is important here, as you, Dasha, mentioned, Russia uses these tactics of terror against civilians. So they do not target military objects. They target civilian infrastructure and residential areas. And every day, Ukrainian civilians get wounded or even die. And at during one of the attacks on the night of the 6th of April, during the drone attack, mixed drone and missile attack, Russia killed 7 civilians in Kharkiv and destroyed and damaged a lot of residential buildings. And what is also worth mentioning, that Russia uses these double tap tactics more and more often. We talked about these tactics when I told you about the ballistic attack on Odessa, during which 21 persons were killed. So these tactics, while launching one ballistic missile to a certain area and firing the next one to the same place after some time, it's actually a violation of international humanitarian law, and Russians are using these tactics more and more often. So when we talk about the directions of these attacks, as I've mentioned, the first targets are civilians and civilian infrastructure, and another one is critical infrastructure, meaning energy sector of Ukraine. And in the previous episode, we told you about the attacks, new waves of attacks against Russian energy infrastructure and its unprecedented scale. So these attacks are still ongoing, and Russia is trying to target Ukrainian energy infrastructure, and several attacks like this happened over the past week. And it also led to blackouts in certain regions of Ukraine. But our energy engineers are doing impossible things to provide Ukrainians with electricity and all the basic needs. And making conclusions of what tactics Russia uses to destroy Ukrainian energy infrastructure. Unlike the situation of the previous year, of the last year, now Russians are using high precise missiles to destroy power grids and all the critical infrastructure to provide Ukrainians with electricity. So another important feature is that the hits are not that large scale as it was before. So we do not have this much, let's say the amount of damages is not that much, but when Russians hit certain objects, it gets more severely damaged. So it's not about the amount of objects, but about the scale of damage. And many critical, like big power generation entities, power generation objects, cannot be restored until next winter. So they are mostly completely ruined. And if we talk about the statistics, in the end of March, from 22nd of March to the 29th of March, Russia targeted two hydropower electric plants and seven thermal electric plants. And they especially choose those regions and those objects where there is no enough air defense capabilities. And Russia uses these terror methods of waging war against Ukrainians and destroying everything and everyone they can. While Ukraine is waging this war, this defensive war itself, war using military strategy and not violating actually the international law. And while Russia is terrorizing Ukraine, Ukrainian defense forces are elaborating special operations that are aimed at undermining Russian military capabilities. And one of such instances was the drone attack on the Shahed drones production and assembling facilities. And what is interesting to note here, that these facilities are located in Tatarstan, in the Yelabuga region, which is 1,200 kilometers away from Ukraine. So it means that Ukraine is developing its drones capabilities, and now it can launch strike drones to such long distances, which is success, and there are prospects of better and more effective strikes against Russian military objects. And talking about these special operations and strikes, like Ukraine is trying to deprive Russia of the possibility to supply its troops, and here we talk about this. Military factories or oil refineries. But Russia, understanding it, and especially after the successful special operations by Ukrainian Defense Forces against Russian fleet, namely the large landing ships, which were used by Russians to provide military cargoes to their troops in Ukraine. The Russians are thinking about alternative logistical routes, and that's actually threatening for Ukraine. And here I'm talking about the railway Rostov-Crimea, which is on the final stage of being built. And it's a long railway which goes from Rostov via Donetsk and occupied parts of Donetsk and Zaporizhia region, and it ends in Crimea. So for Ukrainian armed forces, according to military, it might be challenging to cut it, to blow it up. And this railway is going to be used to supply the Russian troops that are located in the southern part of Ukraine. And it is especially dangerous when Ukraine is close to causing heavy damage to Crimea Bridge. And that's what Ukraine was counting on. And according to our military intelligence, like the possibility of destroying Kerch Bridge was real. But now, if this railway is going to be functional, the significance of special operations against this Crimean breach may be diminished because Russia has found the alternative way to supply necessary cargoes to its troops.
And the new railway line that UNESTA mentioned is going to reduce the time from the Russian army to deliver ammunition and equipment to the southern front by about 2 days or 800 kilometers compared to the existing logistics capabilities. And what can I say? To improve logistics in the south, Russia is building this four-lane bypass highway. But I guess victory starts with each of us through decolonizing narratives we use, through taking decisive stance we articulate, and through holding aggressor accountable and discouraging it from another attack.
This was a podcast explaining Ukraine by Ukraine World, a multilingual website about Ukraine. This was a regular conversation between Anastasia Herasimchuk and Daria Senhayevska, journalist and analyst at Ukraine World. Ukraine World is brought to you by Internews Ukraine, one of the largest Ukrainian media NGOs. My name is Volodymyr Yarmolenko. I'm Ukraine World's chief editor and Ukrainian philosopher. You can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld. You can also support our volunteer trips to the front lines at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. You can find these links in the description of this episode. Stay with us and stand with Ukraine.